of fact. And this move that the Chinese helped negotiate, it also solved one of the biggest crises in the history of West Asia, which is the Saudi atrocities and the Saudi war upon the Yemeni people. Even that issue was solved. And I think it is after the resolution of the Yemeni war that now we truly see that the influence of U.S. foreign policy, we see that it will eventually become non-existential with BRICS, with the influence, with the economic, diplomatic, and political influence that the Islamic Republic has in this region. I think definitely there's no doubt that the region will move away from Western domination and will truly become sovereign in its right.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Historian and journalist Breck Jonkers from Hasselt, Belgium, and human rights activist Mohsen Aghvi joining us from Houston, Texas. Thank you for contributing to the program, and a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 35 to 37 of Surah Ali Imran, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dhurriyatan ba'dhuha min ba'dhin wallahu samiyun alim. إذ قالت امرأة عمران رب إني نذرت لك ما في بطني محررا فتقبل مني إنك أنت السميع العليم فلما وضعتها قالت رب إني وضعتها أنثى والله أعلم بما وضعت وليس الذكر كالأنثى وإني سميتها مريم وإني أعيذها بك وذريتها من الشيطان الرجيم فَتَقَبَّلَهَا رَبُّهَا بِقَبُولٍ حَسَنٍ وَأَنْبَتَهَا نَبَاتًا حَسَنًا وَكَفَّلَهَا زَكَرِيَّا كُلَّمَا دَخَلَ عَلَيْهَا زَكَرِيَّا الْمِحْرَابَ وَجَدَ عِنْدَهَا رِزْقًا قَالَ يَا مَرْيَمُ أَنَّى لَكِ هَذَا قالت هو من عند الله إن الله يرزق من يشاء بغير حساب.
In the name of Allah, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. When the wife of Imran said, My Lord, dedicate to you what is in my belly in consecration, accept it from me. Indeed, you are the All Hearing. The all-knowing. And when she bore her, she said, My Lord, I have borne a female child, and Allah knew better what she had borne, and the female is not like the male. I've named it Mary, and I commend her and her offspring to your care against evil of the outcast Satan. Thereupon her Lord accepted her with a gracious acceptance, and made her grow up in a worthy fashion, and he charged Zechariah with her care. Whenever Zechariah visited her in the sanctuary, he would find provision with her. He said, O Mary, from where does this come for you? She said, It comes from Allah. Allah provides whomever he wishes without any reckoning.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Pyongyang says it has staged what it calls a simulated tactical nuclear attack drill in response to joint military war games with the U.S. and South Korea. Israelis have once again taken to the streets to protest against, quote, the judicial coup proposed by PM Netanyahu's far-right cabinet. Also in the headlines, thousands rally in front of the French military base in Niger to renew calls for the withdrawal of French forces from the African country.
Well, welcome to the studios from the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea confirms it staged a, quote, simulated tactical nuclear attack drill during the weekend with mock atomic warheads attached to two long-range cruise missiles. The missiles were fired from the country's west coast toward the Yellow Sea. Pyongyang said the operation on Saturday was a counteraction drill in response to the joint military activity by the U.S. and South Korea. The launches come 3 days after the DPRK fired a pair of short-range ballistic missiles as part of a similar drill. This comes as Seoul and Washington have ramped up their joint military exercises with advanced stealth jets and U.S. strategic assets. Pyongyang says the U.S. and the South are pursuing, quote, confrontation hysteria, adding that it views such war games as a rehearsal for invasion. Washington and Seoul claim that they are defensive in nature. Our correspondent Frank Smith says the U.S.-backed U.N. sanctions against the Democratic People's Republic of Korea are an impediment to Washington's engagement with Pyongyang.
The U.S. always says it's open to negotiations, but really the big elephant in the room for the United States, of course, is the U.S.-supported United Nations Security Council sanctions against North Korea that prevent North Korea from trading with the international community. North Korea has said on many occasions that it will negotiate with the U.S. if it drops its hostile policy. It views the promotion and continued sanctions against North Korea as hostile. It prevents North Korea from developing its economy and has some other consequences that go far beyond the sort of goals of those sanctions to make it difficult for North Korea, for example, to grow its own food. If it doesn't have access to oil, it doesn't have the drivers in the economy that fuel tractors, for example. So it has a whole knock-on effect that strike the North Korean people and not necessarily the leadership. So again, it's these United Nations Security Council sanctions that U.S. might have to, and certainly the council should look at, suspending in order to encourage North Korea to come to the negotiating table, draw down the tension, and really put things on another foot moving forward.
Tens of thousands of Israelis are back on the streets of Tel Aviv for the 35th consecutive week to protest against what they call a judicial coup.
I came out here today with my family so that we can protest against the judicial coup. It's a crucial time right now. We need to come out. We need to be in the streets. We have a big vote in about 2 weeks, and I can't tell you that I'm hopeful, but we are not going to stop coming out until we're able to turn back and make sure that everyone has someone else watching over what they're doing. Nobody has the power to make changes at their whim.
Mass protests against the so-called judicial overhaul have been ongoing since it was proposed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extreme far-right cabinet back in January. In August, Israel's Supreme Court began hearing the first in a series of appeals linked to the overhaul, which set off an unprecedented domestic crisis. Israel is now facing public unrest, labor strikes, and mutiny by some members of its military. The opposition believe the cabinet is aiming to weaken the judiciary and to prevent it from being able to maintain checks and balances on the cabinet. They say that the protests will continue until they are able to repeal the legislation. Israeli troops have violently clashed with Eritrean refugees using live fire and stun grenades against the demonstrators who were protesting against the government in the East African nation. Some 160 were injured, some of them critically. Many others were arrested. The violence broke out around an event organized by the Eritrean embassy to mark Revolution Day, which commemorates the start of the Eritrean War of Independence against Ethiopia in 1961. President Isaias Afwerki has ruled since Eritrea gained independence in 1993. Human rights groups have condemned his government as being highly repressive. Eritreans make up the majority of the more than 30,000 African asylum seekers in Israel. The Tel Aviv regime has been under fire by rights groups for racism and discrimination against non-white individuals. Political commentator Gerald Horn says that Jews from different nationalities are treated differently due to a system of bigotry and discrimination in Israel.
Israel is a sink of bigotry and discrimination. Recall that there are so-called Mizrahi Jewish folk from Morocco, stretching eastward through North Africa into as far as Iran, who consider themselves to be second-class citizens as well. Even though they are of Jewish descent, there is a nagging perception in Israel that the Jewish population from Eastern Europe are privileged over other Jewish populations. And then there's the fact that Israel is deeply influenced by the United States of America. Recall that many of the settlers on Palestinian territory actually hail from the United States of America. I'm speaking of Jewish Americans of European descent. And it's no secret that the United States specializes in anti-blackness, which brings us to the demonstrations involving Eritreans. They are black people, which means that they are not necessarily high on the totem pole.
Fresh details have emerged from a major Israeli sabotage attempt against Iran's defense industries that was thwarted by the country's intelligence. Military officials say that a professional team led by Mossad was trying to equip missile connectors with explosive circuits, which could be programmed to blow up at a specific time.
It's a plot out of a Hollywood movie, but with serious repercussions. a shadow war between Israel and Iran. This one involves an Israeli plot to sabotage Iran's defense industry, including missiles, the biggest military sabotage attempt against Iran in the past 100 years. It is one that failed, however, just in the nick of time. The agency's statement reveals the scope of the operation. The intelligence unit of the Defense Ministry thwarted one of the largest sabotage plots targeting Iran's missile, aviation, and aerospace military industry. This sabotage was carried out under the guidance of the Zionist intelligence services and their agents. A network of agents sought to introduce defective parts into the production of advanced missiles, specifically defective connectors from abroad. The defective parts were discovered by the Defense Ministry Information Protection. The plan was to equip these connectors with explosive circuits. If that was done successfully, the connectors could be programmed to explode remotely at any time.
The Israeli spy agency Mossad has been at the heart of anti-Iran plots for decades. Simply put, it has targeted Iran in order to stop its advancements in a variety of fields. But apparently what has been of interest is Iran's nuclear program and Iran's defense industry. This includes targeting scientists and nuclear facilities.
Under the false pretext of preventing Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons, Mossad has been carrying out a campaign of sabotage and cyber attacks on Iran's civilian nuclear program for quite some time. One of the notorious ones was the Stuxnet virus. In April 2011, Iranian government official Ghulam Reza Jalali stated that an investigation had concluded that both the United States and Israel were behind the Stuxnet attack. Mossad has also methodically assassinated and murdered Iranian nuclear scientists, from magnetic bombs attached to the side of their cars, to the use of poison, and allegedly the use of a killer robot remotely used as an assassin. Additionally, Israel has also targeted Iran's nuclear facilities. Israel's targeting of Iran's defense industry, in particular its drones and missile program, does make sense from Israel's point of view. Iran has made extraordinary advancements in these two fields and military hardware overall. But all of these destructive actions, which Israel has not claimed responsibility for, has not been able to stop Iran's advancement. From Israel's perspective, it makes strategic sense, though only a temporary fix. There's an Iranian saying that says, "Don't play with the lion's tail." Iran may have thwarted these acts of sabotage, but for how long will its patience last when it comes to Israel?
Iran and Iraq inaugurate the construction project of a major railroad as part of a growing partnership between Tehran and Baghdad. The Shalamcheh-Basra connection project will link the major port city of Basra in southern Iraq to Iran's vast railway network through the Shalamcheh border crossing. It is estimated that the project will take between 18 to 24 months. The project had been under discussion for years before an agreement was reached in 2021. It was inaugurated by Iran's first Vice President Mohammad Mukhber and the Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammad Shia al-Sudani. Mukhber says the project will be completed over the next 2 years. Both Iran and Iraq are political and economic partners and are determined to enhance their bilateral trade relations. Iranians are marking the National Day of Fight Against British Colonialism, commemorating the 109th anniversary of the martyrdom of Rais Ali Delvari, a great national hero and independence fighter who led the anti-colonial struggle in southern Iran. However, this year the occasion is even more special, as many Iranians have had the chance to mark this day where he has been laid to rest. Gisumi Shahmadi reports.
Remembering a national hero, a symbol of resistance. Many Iranians this year are marking the National Day Against British Colonialism at the resting place of a man who organized a popular resistance movement against British troops that had invaded Iran in 1915. Rais Ali Dilvari's martyrdom anniversary has fallen just days before Arbaeen, allowing pilgrims who are taking part in the Arbaeen Walk to mark the occasion at his resting place in Wadi As-Salam Cemetery in the Iraqi city of Najaf, where the pilgrimage begins.
Shahid Delwari.
Rais Ali Delwari was a hero just like Martyr Qasem Soleimani in our days. Actually, as Iranians, I think we're lucky that we had quite a number of these freedom fighters. For example, the Jangad movement of Gilan and the Tangistanis who formed the main resisting power against the British Empire in southern Iran.
We know that he was a young man living in the city of Dilwar in Bushehr province, and he successfully fought against the British invaders. That is why we have to keep his memory alive and educate our young generation about him.
Martyr Rais Ali Delwari played an important role in the fight against colonialism. As Iranians, we owe him our independence and freedom.
Rais Ali Delwari was born in 1261 in Dilwar in Bushehr. After the sudden entrance of British forces into the southern province in 1915, he led the Iranian army in their fight against British colonialists. Rais Ali Delwari was ultimately killed by Anglo-Indian forces following months of bloody clashes. Today, his home has been turned into a museum and registered as a national heritage in Iran. And to commemorate him, his martyrdom anniversary, which usually falls on the 3rd of September, is marked on the Iranian calendar as a national day of fight against British colonialism.
Decades after his martyrdom, Rais Ali Delwari is still an inspiration, not just for Iranians, but for freedom fighters worldwide. Isum Shahmadi, Wadi As-Salam Cemetery, Najaf.
Thousands of people in Niger have held an anti-French rally demanding that the former colonial ruler withdraw his military personnel from the West African nation. The demonstration was held in front of a French military base in the capital Niamey. It came a day after the military rulers accused Paris of blatant interference in the country's affairs. 1,500 French troops are currently stationed in Niger. The junta in power has ordered French troops to leave the West African nation until September 3. Niger also last week called on the French ambassador to leave the country within 48 hours. Paris brushed aside the decision, arguing that the junta has no authority to make such a decision. On July 26, the military takeover ousted President Mohamed Bazoum and installed General Abdurrahmane Tchiani, the leader of the presidential guard, as head of state. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Arbaeen, Journey of Zealous Hearts. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Here it seems that your mind is soaring and growing, like your heart that has become vast and kind, as if your heart has accommodated all of Imam Hussein's pilgrims. Black and white, race and language don't matter for you, and you love every pilgrim with no reason, and you like to express this love. How pure you have become, O pilgrim! Little by little, you resemble Hussein. As the Arbaeen of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, is approaching, the annual rendezvous of Hussein's lovers is repeated. The distance between Najaf and Karbala is reminiscent of a special fervor for the lovers of Hussein who set off on foot toward Karbala. The pilgrims, from the very beginning of the course, step in their trek of love with a very light rucksack and simple shoes. They have separated themselves from worldly attachments and material pleasures to march the course step by step. Their hearts are restless to reach the shrine of Hussein, peace upon him, and touch the pure edifice that has engulfed the chief of martyrs. pilgrims are unquiet like Zainab, who exerted her utmost to get to you on Arba'in so that she could soothe her scathed and burnt heart beside you, O Hussein. The magnet of love has absorbed the enthusiasts for over 1,000 years to march toward your shrine on foot. O Hussein, O Imam of Affection, our hearts have also drawn toward your mausoleum. So fill our hearts with light and cognizance by your kind look and grant us serenity. Marching toward Karbala on foot on the 40th day of Imam Hussein's martyrdom is an old tradition, as the renowned companion of the Prophet, Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari, together with his servant Atiyah, left Medina for Karbala on foot in 61 AH to get to the shrine of Imam Hussein exactly on the 40th day of his martyrdom. According to the historical books, the pilgrimage of Imam Hussein's shrine was so fervent and inspiring in the early years after his martyrdom that the ungodly Umayyad regime had no choice but to prevent the spread of this tradition and disclosure of its injustices by the pilgrims. Nevertheless, the fifth and sixth infallible successors of the Prophet, namely Imam Muhammad Baqir and Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon them, would encourage Muslims to embark on pilgrimage at night, not to be recognized and arrested by the ruling regime. The Abbasids ordered the holy shrine of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, to be destroyed as soon as the pillars of their oppressive rule were reinforced. These two usurper dynasties wielded the most heinous punishments against the followers of the Ahlul Bayt who would venture to go on pilgrimage of Imam Hussein's shrine. These oppressions, detentions, and violent acts continued till the end of Saddam's rule in Iraq. But the zeal of the lovers of Imam Hussein has never subsided, and this spiritual bond was never cut. In this hugest gathering of human beings in the world, you see the newborns with their parents, old men and women who move on with much difficulty but very ardently. The columns by the road give you the promise that you are going closer and closer to visit the shrine of your beloved Hussein in Karbala. At the two sides of the road, there are innumerable stands which render every kind of service to the pilgrims. The Iraqi people spend unstintingly whatever they have. They slaughter sheep, make food, serve water, tea and coffee, and provide warm place for pilgrims. A man who is the elderly of his family says, "I allocate a bulk of my annual income for these days, and on the day of Arba'in I spend it with love for the pilgrims of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. From the time that I've made a vow, God has bestowed special blessing to my life, and whatever I have is from Imam Hussein, peace upon him." The love and affection of these people for Imam Hussein is indescribable. One must go on this trip to see their state and mood. They entreat the passers-by to step in their tent for a meal or resting. The tents of the Red Crescent, scattered here and there, give medical services freely. You can see physicians who offer voluntary service to the pilgrims to be rewarded by God and draw the attention of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Some others are sitting over there waiting for polishing your shoes. However, one of the most attractive manifestations of the love of Iraqi people for the pilgrims is the scene of massaging tired pilgrims and putting ointments on their fatigued and blistered feet. What is all this? What is going on in this colossal convergence of the faithful? A man with tearful eyes has put his sick child on the wheelchair and appeals to Imam Hussein and Hazrat Abbas, peace upon them, to cure his beloved child. Karen Ferby is a Christian girl who has come to Iraq to see the unmatched scenes of Arba'een marching. She keeps taking photos to demonstrate them in her country, Belgium, while she regrets that there is no such a colossal gathering in the world of Christianity. There are many new Muslims from Europe, Africa, Asia, and Australia who have joined this huge gathering to show their love to the chief of martyrs. Hujjatul Islam Ali Reza Panahian says, "As long as human being hasn't gone to Karbala, hasn't marched toward Karbala among the massive gathering of the lovers of Hussein, peace upon him, and hasn't felt that attractive and unique climate, he cannot understand its splendor, grandeur, and boundless pleasure, and cannot sense the warmth that is created by this move in his heart. Here you seem to be more sincere with yourself. You are in the midst of the hustle and bustle of the people, but your thought is freer. You ask yourself why you have stepped in this course. Are you going to act like the people of Kufa and turn your back to the truth and counter it when Islam needs you? You reflect, as if your mind soars and grows like your heart that has grown and become kinder. It seems that your heart has accommodated all lovers of Hussein, peace upon him." Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, "He who leaves his house for the pilgrimage of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, God will write a reward for every step he takes and separates him from an evil. And when he gets to the shrine, places him among the selected righteous. And once his rituals are finished, God writes his name among the victorious. And when he wants to come back, a divine angel stands in front of him and says, 'The messenger of God greets you and gives you the message to start your deeds anew, for your previous sins have been forgiven.'"
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
We'll be right back.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in this program, we will discuss India and Iran dropping the arbitration clause for Chabahar Port and India's moon mission making significant development. So stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss Iran and India drop foreign arbitration clause in Chabahar Port issue. And we shall also take a look at India's Chandrayaan 3 makes a historic landing on the moon.
In a bold stride, India and Iran have jointly decided to drop the foreign arbitration clause surrounding the Chabahar Port issue. This landmark decision clears the path for a substantial long-term agreement propelling the development of this strategic port. This maneuver, underpinned by mutual understanding, not only carries the potential to reshape bilateral ties, but also regional connectivity and boost investor confidence. The crucial development comes at a juncture when both nations are seeking to fortify their economic and strategic cooperation.
The recent decision to abandon the foreign arbitration clause in the Chabahar Port marks a significant shift in the trajectory of India-Iran relations. Both the sides have conquered their disputes between users and operators at the Chabahar Port will no longer be subjected to commercial arbitration in foreign courts. Instead, the mechanism of investment arbitration or alternative modes of dispute settlement will be pursued. This pragmatic approach will not only streamline the resolution process, but will also avoid the necessity for Iran to amend its constitution. Tehran and New Delhi have agreed that arbitration will be conducted under the auspices of UN Commission on International Trade Law, a favored choice of India over other trade arbitration mechanisms. According to experts, this move demonstrates the dedication of both the countries to create a conducive environment for fostering collaboration, paving the way in future for formal agreements and facilitating a seamless maritime route between Iran and India.
The Chabahar Port, nestled on Iran's southeastern coast, has emerged as a pivotal corridor connecting India and Central Asia. Beyond its geographical significance, this port holds the promise of bolstering regional trade, enhancing connectivity, and also reshaping diplomatic dynamics. For India, it offers a direct maritime route to Afghanistan and beyond, bypassing Pakistan. Against this backdrop of strategic importance, the recent decision by India and Iran to drop the foreign arbitration clause ushers in a new chapter in Chabahar's development.
In a region where connectivity holds immense significance, this decision carves a new trajectory for India and Iran relations. As a testament to the significance of this decision, a team from India's Ministry of Port and Shipping is set to visit Iran in September. The team will be solidifying an agreement on the rules of engagement and the mode of arbitration. Experts say this diplomatic breakthrough has an array of cascading benefits. A long-term agreement would inject a sense of certainty into investment and development plans for the port. The newfound stability could further bolster the confidence of stakeholders in the viability of the Chabahar Port's role as a strategic connectivity hub. Notably, the shift comes at a juncture when Iran has joined the BRICS expansion's first phase, amplifying its regional influence. Foreign affairs analysts say that diplomatic momentum has seen an increase as both sides are poised to expedite infrastructure collaboration, Chabahar Port being at the forefront.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Senior Fellow and Head of West and Central Asia Centre, Tilotoma Foundation, Dr. Meena Singh Roy from New Delhi. First of all, welcome to the programme, Doctor.
Thank you. Pleasure is all mine to be part of the discussion.
You're welcome, Miss. Now, let's start begin with the removal of the arbitration clause for the Chabahar Port. It signifies a major shift in India-Iran commercial relations. So my question would be, what economic implications would this move have on both countries?
Let me start with a little context to this whole debate on Chabahar as a linking bridge, not only bilaterally, but also trilaterally and regionally. So I think, you know, it's been a process which has been on for many years when we started working on Chabahar agreement. But you see, there were many limitations in between, despite the fact that there was a vision There was interest, and there was interest at the top leadership level. And the weakest part of India-Iran cooperation, I would say, was in the economic arena. We were unable to raise the level of trade between two countries for many reasons. One of it, of course, was the sanctions, and there were many other reasons. And Chabahar actually signifies, you know, India's gateway to Central Asia. And if we look at, you know, a long-term agreement, which India has been looking for, this will not only facilitate, you know, increased economic interaction between India and Iran, but also, you know, India and the broader region as such. The second aspect, you know, that will come to play would be actually, you know, if you look at the figures of non-oil trade between India and Iran, it has gone up in the past few months. If we look at it, there has been change in the trajectory of India-Iran trade cooperation. And I think the private sector also would be more willing to chip in. Not only it is the government effort, but we also need to bring in the private players, the private companies to enhance the cooperation. So be it food security, be it, you know, other equipments which we can trade with each other. So this, I guess, will facilitate a greater economic cooperation and taking our bilateral trade to a significant level. We should also understand here that, you know, in the recent sidelines of the BRICS summit, Indian Prime Minister, you know, Mr. Modi, and also, you know, President Raisi, they interacted with each other and have committed to enhance cooperation in various sectors, including infrastructure, energy, and trade. So I guess this is one of the important steps taken by both the countries to facilitate greater trade between the two countries.
That's right, Dr. Singwei. Now, you talked about the meeting that they had at the BRICS. We will talk about that as well. But before that, the Chabahar Port's potential as a connectivity hub has been reiterated by, like you said, by the leaders of both countries. So how will the removal of arbitration clauses contribute to the realization of Chabahar's full potential?
You see, if we are looking at realizing the full potential of Chabahar, there is no doubt, you know, that it is the port which can enhance. But from India's side, you know, they have been looking at the long-term agreement. And if this is done, then obviously, you know, the Iranian initiative in this sense would be also, you know, affecting possibly both. So in terms of signing a long-term agreement is something which would be facilitated by this step. So this is what would take the initiative forward for both the countries. If there were some issues at the end of the Iranian constitution, it was also an, you know, effort taken by India, because India has been insisting on a long-term agreement. And I think, you know, this is what will facilitate the long-term agreement which India has been looking for a long time.
That's right, Ms. Lee. You've also talked about the BRICS as well. So the timing of this agreement coincided with Iran's admission to the BRICS group of countries. So how will Iran's inclusion in BRICS influence its strategic partnerships and also economic engagements?
I think we need to understand today, and I feel that, you know, in the larger context, if we see the global order, it is changing. We see new regionalism, which is emerging, you know, which is free from the domination of the Western rules and regulations. But what we see today, if we look at the expansion of the BRICS, it signifies as to how, you know, Global South, the South-South cooperation is something which signifies the potential of economic trade, infrastructure, energy, and other areas of cooperation which have become the necessity for the developing countries, for the not so developed countries. If we look at the major Asian countries, if we look at the African continent and the Latin America, what we see today is what I would call is the new regional order, which also, wants to trade, in local currencies. Having said this, I also look at it as an interest-based cooperation that the countries are looking for. It is not against any particular country, but it is about the strategic autonomy of these countries who don't want to be dominated and dictated by the rules of the games which have been set for a very long time with the developed countries. And this, I think, is the major significance of the new developments that are happening, the new globalization as I see it. Regionally, I have always said this is the new regionalism which is unfolding today. So acceptance of the new six members, and particularly Iran, I think brings out the new dimension of cooperation in the sectors that can be taken up in future. Our energy, our agriculture, where the food security is becoming the most important aspect post-Russia-Ukraine war. And I think the sanctions which have affected Iran and Russia and many other countries will have certain, impact in terms, positive impact in terms of cooperation among the developing partners.
There you have it, Senior Fellow and Head of the West and Central Asia Center, Tillotoma Foundation, Dr. Meena Singh Roy from New Delhi. Thank you, Miss. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Sarfaraz Ahmed from West Bengal, India posted, India and Iran drop foreign court arbitration from Chabahar port. New move will help firm up longer-term agreement and boost investor confidence in Chabahar. Shahid Anwar, a journalist and blogger, posted, India and Iran have agreed not to seek commercial foreign arbitration for disputes between users and operators at the deep-sea Chabahar port in southeast Iran, paving the way for a long-term deal to develop the strategic hub, Indian media reported. Ayushman Creation Music, a music producer, posted, India and Iran agree to drop arbitration clause for Chabahar port, boosting commercial ties. The two countries have also agreed to increase cooperation in the areas of trade, energy, and connectivity. This development comes at a time when Iran has been admitted to the BRICS group.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
Now let's talk about India's moon mission, Chandrayaan-3. With the success of its lunar mission, India has joined the list of a few countries to have achieved a soft landing on the moon. India's lunar rover, Pragyan, took first steps on the surface of the moon a day after India became the first country to land near the South Pole. The rover roams around the lunar rocks and craters, gathering crucial data and images that are sent back to Earth for analysis.
Pragyan is carrying two scientific instruments which will try to find out what minerals are present on the moon's surface and study the chemical composition of the lunar soil. The rover is communicating only with the lander, which is sending the information to the Indian satellite Chandrayaan-2, circling the moon to further pass it on to Earth for analysis. According to the Indian Space Research Organization, ISRO, the rover will be moving at a speed of 1 centimeter per second. ISRO said the rover recently came across a 4-meter diameter crater positioned 3 meters ahead of its location and was redirected to take a new path. The lander has 4 payloads to study thermal conductivity, temperature, seismicity, and other characteristics of the lunar surface. Of them, 3 payloads, ILSA, RAMBA, and CHAST, have been turned on and are performing normally.
The landing of the rover was greeted with celebrations across India, with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi saying India is now on the moon and India's strides in space will truly benefit humanity in the times to come. According to space scientists, major goals of Chandrayaan-3 is to hunt for water. Huge craters in the South Pole region, which are permanently in shadow, hold ice, which could support human habitation on the moon in the future.
India has become a part of the group of countries, including the US, Russia and China, that have successfully sent their space exploration missions to the moon. However, India's cost-effective space exploration programs make it stand out in the group. The country has been adapting existing technologies to lower the expenses. Chandrayaan-3 had a cost of $74.6 million, which is far lower than most other lunar missions sent by different countries. According to experts, the cost-effectiveness of India's space programs can act as a model for other countries to begin their space exploration ventures. As far as India is concerned, its space missions are advancing further. The country will be launching Space Observatory to study the Sun in September this year. It is also planning to launch a 3-day crewed mission into Earth's orbit by 2024. In 2025, India is scheduled to launch a joint mission with Japan to the Moon and an orbital mission to Venus.
Now to talk more on this significant achievement, we are joined by former Indian Ambassador, Mr. Anil Trigunayat from New Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, sir.
Assalamu alaikum. Shukran.
Thank you, sir. Now, India's Chandrayaan-3 rover, Pragyan, swiftly landed on the South Pole of the Moon. So my question is, why is exploring the lunar South Pole so important?
Well, as you know, that India became the first country in the world to have gone to the southern part of the moon. Most of the other countries, the other three countries have gone to the northern part. And the Chandrayaan especially focused, it was very, very difficult to land there because of the cyclones, because of the climate there, and because of the darkness. So that's why it was a greater challenge for the space exploration. And secondly, it was also felt that it will perhaps give new ideas and new information about the surface of the moon. And this is precisely what it has done. It is also already the rover that has sent information and the pictures. It says that there is possibility of having oxygen there. There is a possibility of titanium and some other minerals also have been explored in the last few days. And of course, in the future, whenever there are journeys beyond the space are required to be conducted, I believe that this is much easier to take off from Moon if you make a station there.
That's right, sir. Now, India's space exploration program is said to be cost-effective. So how can it pave the way for other countries to venture into the field of space research?
Yes, as you know that this Chandrayaan 3 and 2, this is in fact just about $80 million or even less than that, which is the cost of the, which was one third of the cost of a movie Interstellar, which was made by Christopher Nolan. Likewise, when India sent its moon, mission to Mars, that was less than the cost of the Hollywood movie. Now, that shows that it is possible for countries to efficiently explore space with the right technology, with the indigenous technology, to be able to explore the space at a price-competitive manner. And that means it expands the horizon for a very large number of developing countries to participate and explore this space, which India has been doing for 70 years. You know that India has been launching satellites for nearly every country in the world and at a very cost-effective manner. It has also done explorations itself. Its own PSLV, its vehicles, which is the launch vehicles, have improved greatly over the years. And so therefore, it is easier for us to collaborate with all the space agencies in the world at a very highly competitive manner. And that's what, that's why when the commercialization of a space or the technologies begins, it is much more easier and accessible to the developing world than the, as we call it, Global South.
That's right, sir. Sir, I also want to talk about Indian Prime Minister's comments. Narendra Modi said he lauded Chandrayaan's success, saying it will benefit humanity. What does he mean by this?
Well, firstly, let me compliment Iran for joining both the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as well as the BRICS. And Prime Minister Modi was there in Johannesburg when Indian Chandrayaan landed on the moon. And it was something which was absolutely in a very precise manner. And even at the BRICS, he said, this is the victory of the humanity. That means it is available for the humanity to encash, to collaborate with India for these technologies, and we are there. And he even proposed a program under the space program for the BRICS countries. So likewise, when we were in the SAARC, India launched a SAARC satellite for the SAARC countries. So we are doing like this for whether it is for the weather, whether it is for any other usage, communications and others. So India is ready to provide all kind of assistance to all the countries in the world. So that's what when he mentioned, he, according to us, we believe in Vasudhaiv Kutumbakam, which means the world is one family. So therefore, whatever our achievements, those should be available for the global good and the global commons and for the global welfare.
Shared with other people as well. Sir, before we let you go, India plans to send a crewed mission to space, and it also has a joint mission with Japan to Venus. So how do you see India's future space exploration ventures?
Well, the first one we are doing now in a day or two is sending the mission called Aditya L1, which is going to solar system, which is going to sun, basically, and is going to study its trajectories and orbits. Then we are doing it, as you rightly mentioned, we are going to also have something called Gaganyaan. That will be the moon, the man mission, which will be going there. Then we are, of course, with Japan, many other countries, we are doing our space cooperation, which is because, see, we learn from each other. We learn together. And as long as we live in silos, it is not possible to cooperate and to be able to excel. And that is why it is important that we work together, because the space is essentially is infinite. And we have to continue to find, and that's what the whole human quest is, so that this is good for our civilization, this is good for our people, and that's what India is trying to excel and working together with more and more countries in the space sector.
There you have it, former Indian Ambassador Mr. Anil Sregunayat from New Delhi. Now, let's see what people have to say on social media.
X page of Chandrayaan 3 mission posted. Pragyan, can I go for a moonwalk? Vikram, yes you can, but keep in touch. Sprinter, a famous netizen, posted. The Indian lunar rover transmitted the first data on the temperature of different layers of the lunar surface. According to the chart presented by the Indian Space Research Organization, the temperature at the depth of 8 cm is about minus 10 degrees Celsius and on the surface of the moon about 60 degrees Celsius. We all thought that the surface temperature could be between 20 to 30 degrees Celsius, but it is surprisingly higher than we expected. ISRO employee V. Durukesh was quoted as saying by the Press Trust of India. Paul Seren, a writer and musician from Brazil, posted, the sun and the moon, while Pragyan rover studies temperatures on the lunar surface, Indian space program gears up for September launch of probe to study solar winds.
And that was our episode on Iran and India's recent development at Chabahar Port and India taking another leap in space exploration. We shall meet again next week. Till then, take great care.
In the Limelight.
The National Council for the Safeguard of the Homeland, CNSP, which is now in power in Niger, has prohibited activities of international organizations, including the UN agencies, in military zones. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted the military leaders in Niger who seized power in July have barred United Nations agencies, non-governmental organizations, and other international agencies from working in its military operation zones, the Interior Ministry announced recently. The directive comes in response to the current security situation and the ongoing operational engagement of the Nigerian Armed Forces, the ministry said in a statement aired on national television and reported by local media. All activities and/or movements of the organizations in the zones of operations are temporarily suspended, the statement said, without specifying the affected regions. The UN pledged days after the military takeover to remain engaged and committed amid the crisis in Niger, where it said 3.3 million people are food insecure. In July, UN Acting Resident Coordinator Nicole Kasi expressed concern about the temporary suspension of the organization's humanitarian air service flights after the leaders closed Niger's airspace. Last month, Niger's new military rulers announced the cancellation of a number of military agreements with France, which has some 1,500 troops stationed in Niamey. However, Paris has refused to withdraw its forces, arguing that the cooperation agreements were signed with the legitimate authorities of its former colony. The French government has repeatedly denied Niger's new rulers' legitimacy and has declined to comply with their directives, including a recent demand that the French ambassador leave Niamey within 48 hours. The military leaders are also at odds with the West African Regional Bloc, ECOWAS, which has taken